from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The story from a viral video involving Catholic school students continues this morning with Nathan Phillips, the Native American activist shown drumming in the video, being interviewed on the Today Show. Phillips' interview comes one day after the program featured an interview with Nick Sandman, the Covington Catholic High School student in the MAGA hat who was captured in the stare down with Phillips at the Lincoln Memorial. That Friday incident engulfed social media, prompted threats of violence against Sandman, walkbacks from members of the media, a takedown of Phillips' character, not to mention feelings of anger, indignation, and even heartache for some. Now, 6 days out, having learned more about the incident, we want to talk it out with a psychologist from NYU and also find out from you, our listeners, what your thoughts, questions, and takeaways are of this incident. You can join the conversation by calling 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org, post your comments on Facebook, Twitter, or on our website, kqed.org/forum. Joining us now is Jay Van Babel. He's Associate Professor of Psychology at New York University. Good morning, Jay Van Babel.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. You've done research on these types of incidents, and I just want to start by asking you what your observations, your takeaways are on this day at this point.
Yeah, I'm happy to weigh in. So what I see is an unfolding of different parts of psychology kind of on a daily basis. So what we see now is essentially almost two opposite interpretations of the same set of events, where, you know, people on the left are rewatching the video. Many are still interpreting it as there's harassment going on and a mob-like mentality, and they're digging into kind of the broader context of the history of the school and school district to make sense of it. And then there is another interpretation of the exact same set of video evidence from people on the right and supporters of the president who are interpreting it as mob behavior online and a piling on of these kids who are involved in this. And so there's certainly a lot of research showing how people from the left and right can see the same event. Indeed, there's a study where they looked at the same exact video of a crowd, and people on the left and the right interpret it very differently depending on who they think was at fault or who was involved in the crowd.
What do you mean? What is this video of the crowd? Can you describe that?
There's a very famous study called They Saw a Protest, and in it they showed clips of a protest. And what they did was they simply manipulated who people believed was actually engaged in the protest, and so whether or not it was a pro-left rally or pro-right rally. And when people on the left saw the video clip and they thought it was a pro-right rally, they interpreted it as more aggressive. When people on the right saw the exact same video clip and they were told it was a pro-left rally, that's when they saw it as more aggressive. And so it really is partly what we think is happening changes how we filter and interpret the exact same event.
But it's hard, I think, and even insulting for people to hear that they cannot believe their own eyes. So how do you get past that?
So obviously adding more context helps, and this is where journalism and shows like this are useful. But it's going to be next to impossible for everybody to bring the same lens to the situation, especially when it's ambiguous. So I like to think of this as like a Rorschach for politics, like the very famous way where you show ink blots to people and they just kind of free associate what they're thinking. Well, what's happening here is there's enough ambiguity about that you don't know exactly the intentions of some of the people in the videos. And so people naturally use their identities and ideologies to fill in the gaps.
One of the other things that you've been remarking on is the consequences of what you define viral outrage. What are the issues that you identify with that?
So we've done some research, my lab and my collaborators, and we found that when people use moral and emotional language on Twitter, it's more likely to go viral. So for every additional moral emotional word you use, like the word disgust or hate or furious, messages about 20% more likely to get retweeted. But what ends up happening is it only gets shared within a group of like-minded people. So liberals only share messages like that with other liberals. Conservatives only share messages like that with other conservatives. And so it ends up going viral, but kind of creating what looks like two echo chambers where people are just talking amongst themselves. And so that's, I think, part of what's happened with issues like this in the kind of culture war. They get talked about like that, and it ends up being divisive. The second thing that happens is there is research showing that when somebody says something offensive or makes an offensive gesture online, people tend to jump in and criticize online. This is something most of us have seen or been a part of. But once too many people start criticizing and the outrage itself goes viral, then people start feeling empathy for the person who initially made the offensive gesture. And so it's almost like they see this as being disproportional to the initial offense, and then they start to sympathize with the individual involved.
So can you connect that to this incident specifically, how that played out in your view?
Yeah, so in my view, what happens with these kids from the Covington School is the initial videos attracted criticism, but the criticism itself became so viral. So many tens of thousands of people were talking about it. Millions of people were reading it and seeing it in their feeds. And that's when people started to see the criticism as disproportionate. And then they started to empathize more with the individuals who were involved in the video from the school.
You mean with Sandman, with the other students from Covington Catholic High School?
Yeah.
And so that's what you mean by backfiring. If somebody is trying to draw attention to an incident, which in and of itself may actually be an aggressive incident, that in and of itself can be distorted if people start to feel that the response was over the top. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And I'll just put it in the context of our legal system, that we have punishments that are designed to match the severity of certain crimes. And what we see is a form of social punishment happening with public criticism and shaming, and some people are trying to dox these individuals. Once bystanders or third-party observers see that, they start to feel as if maybe it's gone too far, maybe if the person has suffered too much already, and that any continued criticism is beyond the pale.
And doxing, of course, is when you release somebody's personal information online so that others can harass and basically.
That's correct.
Yes. And so, well, let me go to some of our listeners who are calling in right now. And I'm going to start with Dave in Berkeley. Hi, Dave.
Hello. I'm reminded in this discussion that there are, for argument's sake, some liberals who aren't perfectly wonderful people, and there are some conservatives who aren't perfectly bad people. And I think what's happening with social media is it's exposing that human beings are both good and evil, and that these things exist in everybody. And, even though we're in a time right now where it seems like, oh, the Republicans are so bad, thankfully we've got, a two-party government. I'd welcome any comments on that.
Dave, thanks.
Yeah, I'd be happy to weigh in on that. So I think this is one thing that social media does, is it can turn a lot of our conversations into almost one-dimensional caricatures of other groups. We start to use stereotypes, start to refer them all one way, but it ignores or it kind of glosses over the complexity of people. So when I watched those videos, what I saw was some people who looked like they were clearly, to me, mocking the man who was drumming, Nathan Phillips, but others looked like they were just laughing or joining in. Others weren't really saying much. Some appeared to be even making mocking gestures, but then looking around to see if others were going to join in. And when they didn't, they would discontinue it. And so they're looking to see what the norms are for expressions of prejudice. And so sometimes people are trying to sort out what to do, and there's a huge variation in the people. And some of the people surely probably did not agree with what was going on, but were just kind of in the situation. So this is obviously a challenge in the way that we communicate with one another now on social media.
Well, Jake says, if you think it's a crime to wear a MAGA hat, then you're automatically biased in such a way that you cannot see what really happened. What are some of the key things that you think are triggers in this incident, and how does it you know, basically intersect with what you've studied with regard to our psychology and how we respond to these types of things?
That's a great question. I would say you kind of hit it right on the nose there when you said the MAGA hat. So what people see when they see the MAGA hat is, you know, the individual wearing it could be supporting Donald Trump for a number of reasons, but when people see it, they interpret it through the context of things that Trump has said, for example, about Aboriginals or Elizabeth Warren's ancestry or about other minority groups, and they automatically infer that the person wearing it in a context like this kind of carries those beliefs. And that may be true in some cases, but clearly it's a massive stereotype to apply to all people who wear that hat. And so this is one of the issues is there's an ambiguity in how we interpret that, but we fill it in through the lens of identity. And we think, well, if we don't like that group or we're not part of it, we interpret it through the darker sides of the actions of that group.
Why else? So that sounds like it's one of the reasons that this spread like wildfire, this particular incident, this image, this short video. What other things do you think are there that are now such essentially powder kegs, I guess, that made this thing go viral and become a national controversy?
I think what's happening is it's piggybacking on several years now we've had of a conversation about racism, discrimination. Obviously, the shutdown's going on right now, and so this is part of the conversation, and it's over the wall, and keeping illegal immigrants out of the country. And so this rhetoric is what is basically the foundation that these actions are kind of piggybacking on. And so when we interpret it, we don't interpret it the same way that we might have, say, 3 years ago. We interpret it through the lens of what's going on now. And what people are reading in the news is leading them to kind of fill in the gaps of their knowledge and interpret it through that lens. And it's quite possible that some of the people in the videos are trying to embody what they think the president believes or what he said, but it's always unclear.
The other trigger, well, SK tweets, the smirk on Sandman's face says it all. It is full of hate and meant to be menacing. Certainly Sandman's smirk was something that really also seemed to be talking to a larger social context in many people's view.
Yeah, so this is the other thing is if you're a minority group member and you've been harassed or discriminated, and you've probably seen a similar face like that before in these circumstances, and so it's easy for those people to make sense of it through that lens. The challenge, at least from a psychological perspective, is we can't perfectly interpret what's going on in someone's mind based on their facial expression. And so there is, again, a bit of ambiguity there in terms of whether it was malice or not. Some people suggested he might have been there in solidarity. That, to me, seems doubtful, but it's not exactly 100% clear what he was thinking.
Okay. Well, fine then if it's hard to gauge someone's intent, but then where does socially situatedness come into it? Where you're situated based on power? Isn't that part of it as well? I mean, for a lot of people, they saw it as the embodiment of white privilege. And if you're a minority group or someone who has felt disempowered, right, how does that come into the conversation? Shouldn't that be given value?
Yeah, that's a great question. I just want to say that a lot of what we're doing right now is trying to interpret the original video clip through all this additional context. So we're looking at other video clips that happened an hour before or 20 minutes before. But there's also a really deep context in this country about the mistreatment of Aboriginals that dates back hundreds of years. And if you're a minority group member in this country and you've been mistreated, certainly if you're Aboriginal and you know that history really well, it's that's part of the context for them. And if you look in the video, you know, you see a small number of people surrounded by 100 students who are jumping around and making loud mocking gestures. It's easy to interpret that as a threatening context.
Well, we've got more calls coming in. I'm going to go next to Emily in Santa Rosa. Hi, Emily.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. This is a very interesting conversation you guys are having, and I just wanted to call in to challenge one of the things that your guest said. You said that if someone is wearing a MAGA hat, it's because they, you know, you might interpret them as being racist because of the comments that the president has made. But I would challenge that and say it's not necessarily that person has the same depth of racist beliefs, but they've accepted the racism of Donald Trump and think that that's an acceptable way to interact with people. And so I think as far as the context goes, I would kind of challenge that a little bit. I think that we all have a general agreement within the United States that racism is unacceptable, and when people wear a MAGA hat, they directly contradict that.
Emily, thanks for your point. Jay Van Babel, do you want to respond?
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with that, that it's there's a reasonable interpretation. If you're wearing that, you're signaling that you at least are willing to look the other way on those issues at a minimum. So that's, again, part of the context that people are seeing and reading into this, and I certainly don't disagree with that interpretation.
Well, let's go next to Chris in Oakland. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Great conversation. Just bouncing off of that last point, it seems that calling this the young men's protest reaction, and in, obviously in the context of the conversation about the wall, which is, I think we can all agree, part of a necessary conversation about immigration. Nevertheless, the gentleman that they were snubbing is a Native American. And so as a psychologist, I was wondering what you thought about the, if we're going to link these two issues, then we're really equating, or some Americans are equating immigrants with non-white Americans, and as a psychologist, how can we help those folks understand this is a racist issue that you are indulging in, and think about how you are indulging in it?
Thanks, Chris. Do you have any thoughts, Jay Van Babel, for Chris?
Yeah, Chris, that was a pointed question, and thanks for raising it. So obviously, for some people, the Aboriginals were here first. I just want to state that as a fact. And then if you're talking about the wall as being a way to keep people out, and if these things are getting linked in people's minds, then the insinuation is it's something about them just being visual minorities, and that's the underlying impetus. And so obviously, for some people, that I think that is the case. There's research showing that these different types of biases or prejudices that people have tend to be correlated with an individual. So people that tend to be biased towards one group on average tend to be more biased against other minority groups. There's no shortage of scientific evidence on that. Of course, you don't know it for any given individual unless you do an actual, you know, assign the measures to them and do it. So I don't want to, I don't have the necessary information to make that conclusion about any of these given individuals, but certainly there are lots of studies linking it. And what we call that is ethnocentrism, that people who tend to be biased against one group tend to have similar biases against other minority groups. And then that motivates their actions on all kinds of policy issues that could range from immigration policy to food stamps across the board. So these things do play a key role in people's policy preferences.
And Jay Van Babel is Associate Professor of Psychology at New York University. I'm struck by something you said in your answer, Jay Van Babel, which is, let's just state that as a fact, because I feel like that's becoming less and less clear or less and less agreed upon in our society. One of the things that, as you mentioned at the very beginning of this conversation, was that we could all look at the exact same footage and come up with a different set of facts in terms of what happened, that we can't agree on the same set of facts around this particular incident, which is what I think I find most startling and also troubling. What happens when we can't agree on a floor of facts with which to have a conversation?
That is the fundamental ingredient to having a healthy democracy, is we're supposed to at least agree on facts, and then we are allowed to have our own opinion about how to proceed with them. It's become incredibly troubling to people, certainly to scientists and the scientific community, that people can't agree on facts. And so I think it's important, and this is why I use the term fact, to state what are the facts historically, what are the things that we know scientifically, but we might not be able to, you know, we're kind of making guesses about how it applies to this situation. And so that's what I'm doing as a psychologist. I don't know what was going on in anybody's mind, and so I'm trying to make clear what we know from the science, but also that we're not 100% sure how that might apply to the situation. So we're kind of making educated guesses based on the science. And so I think it's really important to draw that line, that these are different things, and make it clear when we are stating facts. Now, the problem is when people don't agree on facts, how do you proceed in the conversation? And it's a problem because we can't. And this is why we have fights over all kinds of political things, but also medical issues like vaccination. If you can't agree on what the medical literature says, then you're going to have a hard time convincing people how to proceed in terms of vaccinating their children. So these are major issues. So I think the first thing to do is try to cool down the situation. you try, the other research suggests that people who deliberate and think analytically more are able to get past this partisanship and evaluate information for what's factual and what's not, and that stops them from doing things like believing or sharing fake news. And the other thing I like to do is add information, add context. And so the more and more context you have, the harder and harder it is for you to deny reality. Some people will continue to do it, but it brings a broader and broader group of people on board. And then the final thing is to treat people like complex human beings and understand they might have read a different news source than you or saw a video clip from a different angle. And so they just are bringing different prior beliefs into the interaction. And so maybe if they saw it from a different angle or heard about it from a different perspective, and you can do that empathically, guide them through other information you have and let them do the same for you, you can start to move towards a shared reality.
It sounds like you're giving us tips for what to keep in mind the next time an incident like this happens, because sadly, there will be another, it seems.
Yeah.
Well, Eric says this video was shared online precisely to enrage us and pull us apart. We're still falling for it, and we need to stop. Online mob justice is killing us. We need to stop destroying people, least of all kids, in the court of public opinion. Carol says there are over 2 hours of video of this incident. I think it's important that they're reviewed before anyone starts making statements without knowing the full account of the events. And let's go now to Alexia in Los Gatos. Hi, Alexia.
Hi, thank you. Something that's been bothering me is the fact that the focus is all being kept on these kids and the fact that they're kids. And I have questions for the adults that have or should have some responsibility and accountability in this situation. You know, these kids were on a school trip that was organized by their school. There were chaperones. Why does nobody have questions for those chaperones or the school or their parents about why were these boys at a rally to protest against women's civil rights? Why were they wearing partisan political hats while they were there doing that? There are a lot more questions, and I feel like the adults who should be accountable in this situation are hiding behind their children, and they're keeping all the media attention is also being focused on them, and I don't think it's right to blast those, you know, minor children on social media, but I have questions about, you know, for their parents and their school, and I don't think anybody's asking them, and that's my comment.
Well, Alexia, thanks for sharing that. Again, we're looking at how the viral video involving Covington Catholic High School students that has become a national controversy. We're looking at it from basically a social psychology lens with Jay Van Bavel, associate professor of psychology at NYU. And we're also asking you, 7 days or 6 days out from this incident, because it happened last Friday, where you're at, where you know, how are you feeling, your thoughts, your questions, or even the lessons that you feel like you're taking away from all of this. We go next to Cole in San Francisco. Hi, Cole.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to mention a few things. Actually, in some ways, the previous callers have kind of mentioned it, but one thing I would say is social media has become exhausting with this kind of stuff. It seems like every other week there's something new. If I wasn't a musician or a DJ, I wouldn't be on it, but I have to promote. But one thing I also say is that after we've seen 2+ hours of all this stuff and we've had these things go back and forth, one thing we have to acknowledge is that these boys weren't just there visiting the Capitol. You know, it wasn't like a fun field trip to go to Disneyland or something like that. They were brought there by adults to protest women being able to control their own bodies. And they jumped right into this thing. I wish that the parents and the chaperones would have showed a little bit more discourse and trying to, you know, reel this in. Essentially, this is just another nightmare of social media silliness, and I wish we could get past it. Anyway, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for having this
Cole, thank you for making that point as well. Certainly, there have been concerns about the kids being made out to be more sympathetic actors than is deserved as well, Jay Van Bavel, which also, I think, again, gets into this whole question of where we are situated in society and how that influences the way we perceive their behavior.
Yeah, I'm glad these last two calls have hit on something really important. I think that there's an important focus that needs to move off just to direct one or two people in this video, because it was a large crowd. It was a big event. They were there for political purposes. Many of them are wearing symbols of political identity. And then you have to ask yourself, well, what is the context they're coming from? What are the leaders at the institutions that they're part of signaling to them? And this is when we look at what happens in toxic environments and what elicits toxic behavior, which is something I've also studied and published on, is that there are usually signals coming from leadership about what the identity means, what the norms are, and they can actually frame harm to certain groups or individuals as part of achieving what they see as noble and virtuous goals. And when they do this, their followers end up just creatively jumping in and often doing things that are harmful. And so people in these situations have to think about the institution, the leadership, the signals that are being sent. And I've seen certainly lots of additional context and video and stories about the school and students dressing in blackface at basketball games. Seems like there is a cultural and institutional issue there that goes well beyond the specific kids in the video that have been focused on. And I would encourage people to direct their attentions to the role models in that environment, the adults, the parents, the leaders of the institution, and ask what's going on there that would elicit this type of large-scale behavior.
You're talking about a video, I believe it was from 2012, of students at Covington Catholic High School dressed some in blackface during a basketball game, and that video being promoted on the school's by the school. In terms of framing an institutional responsibility, Olivia tweets, "What really happened here is two different groups were able to move apart without violence. The media organizations who thrust individuals into the temporary spotlight just to forget about them the next day are who really deserve criticism." So she is looking at it from the fact that ultimately this is something that ended rather peacefully to some degree, and how media framing affected people's interpretations. Would you agree that there are a lot of lessons here for our media institutions as well?
Yeah, media institutions would benefit by slowing down and collecting more data before they respond. I often think the best media work is looking at institutional or contextual factors anyways and seeing where other aspects of responsibility might lie. But it's good for them to get a more complete picture. I do think that they're, even though the situation certainly looked intimidating in the videos, there actually was no violence, and that's important to point out. There are certainly different cases where members of minorities are physically harmed by, for example, police shootings, things like that, where an outpouring of outrage and pressure on institutions to deal with these things are certainly justified. In this case, it's more complex because it actually was nonviolent, at least from all the data that I saw. And so,
well, Jay Van Babel, thank you for talking with us this morning. He's associate professor of psychology at NYU, and thanks for sharing your thoughts and insights. We appreciate our listeners calling in. I'm Mina Kim, in today for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.